This is the Voice of Barbados, 92.9 FM. I'm Gregston Seeley at 6 o'clock, and that's time, as per usual on Sunday evenings, to bring you the program, the Better Health Radio Show. And as usual, your host will be Dr. Renee Boyce. Let's see if we can access the good doctor. Good evening to you, doctor.
Hi, good evening, Gregston. How are you?
I am good, thank you. Nice to hear from you.
Yes, nice to be here. Good evening to everybody, and welcome to the Better Health Radio Show, helping you to live your best life. This evening is going to be, as usual, another exciting show full of information to have those questions that you want to have answered. This evening, we'll be discussing a very common, very, very common topic. And joining me is Professor David Corbin. Hi, good evening, Prof. How are you?
Hi, Renee. I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, we had Professor Corbin on, I believe it was last year. He was on with a group of neurologists. Professor Corbin is a neurologist. And at that time, we discussed epilepsy.
That's right.
Yes. And it was fascinating for us in the studio. Professor Corbin was in a sweater and he had a scarf on, and I was all bundled up. And the gentleman who had joined us, they were wearing short pants and slippers and talking about how fine the weather was in the studio. And when I checked their temperature, I think it was about 2 degrees Celsius at the time. I distinctly remember that. It was ridiculous.
Yes, yes. They'd come in from Canada.
Yes. So this evening, Calgary. Remember, it was very cold. Yeah. This evening, we want to jump right into discussing headaches. A very common complaint, and we're going to break down headaches into the different categories. We're going to give ideas of when you should worry about a headache and some things you really didn't know about a headache. So where do we begin, Prof? I know that headaches affect males, females, they affect adults, children, the old, the young. Pretty much at some point in time in the life of an individual, he or she will have a headache.
Yeah, actually, it's rare to find an individual who can say, well, I've never had a headache in my life. But those individuals do exist. So headache then is an indication that something is wrong, usually. So we shouldn't dismiss it. And as we'll discuss as we go along, some headaches come and go. Some tend to linger. And those that linger can become chronic. We tend to use the word chronic when a headache lasts for, say, more than 3 months. But, you know, there are various categories. And I think to start with, one can say that some headaches are due to a condition within the body, like a fever, an inflammation, for example, in the sinuses, which is a very common complaint in among our population.
Yes.
But then maybe it may indicate something mild or may indicate something serious. And that's where the medical practitioner comes in. And a good history needs to be taken. And a good examination needs to be done in all cases before you can say that, oh, this headache is not due to a fever, not due to sinusitis, not due to meningitis, not due to something like a stroke or a problem with, you know, a tumor. So. But in most cases, once the practitioner is convinced that there are no physical signs, then we can go on to talk about what we call the primary headache syndromes, which the most common is migraine. So it is therefore an important function of the health provider to listen. Take a careful history. What has gone before? What is associated with what associated symptoms are there before one can say, well, this is what it's due to. Sometimes one needs to do investigations, sometimes not.
One of the things, Prof, I had researched, because headache is such a common symptom, and this is something that I was surprised to find out. I was researching the frequency of GP visits for headaches to see how often persons went to their doctors with headache as a complaint. And of the top 10 causes for visiting the general practitioner, the first five being colds, hypertension, a checkup, arthritis, and diabetes, headaches was not listed on several groups, several different sites. Headache was not listed in the top 10 complaints people visited their general practitioner for. So it seems that headache is one of those symptoms that persons might just take some over-the-counter medication and maybe rest a little bit, and if the headache goes, then nothing. But let's talk about the common primary headaches, tension headaches and migraine headaches. Migraine.
Yeah. So if you take migraine as a syndrome, then it is definitely more common in ladies and females, or twice as common as in males. And migraine can occur right across the age spectrum. Again, we are often surprised to find that in a child who is susceptible to migraine, they may get other associated symptoms like vomiting, abdominal pain, as one of the first signs that they actually have migraine. So the migraine prevalence in females is around 20%. In males, it's around 10%. So, in other words, right across the age spectrum, and looking at the number of people who may get it right across, it's around 20% in females.
Prof?
Yes.
I have a question. Have they narrowed down or made a final decision as to the underlying cause of migraines?
Well, it used to be thought to be a vascular condition. In other words, due to dilatation of blood vessels. But now we recognize that it is actually due to stimulation of what's known as the trigeminal nerve system. The trigeminal nerve, as you remember, is one of the cranial nerves that is responsible for taking, receiving pain information from the lining of the brain, from the face, and from some structures in the neck as well. Now, the trigeminal system is actually at the center of the causation of migraine. So if the trigeminal system is activated, this causes a release of certain substances which promote pain. And these substances are released around the lining of the brain and cause, promote the onset of pain, and it's now recognized that it is those substances that cause the dilatation of the blood vessels. So dilatation of blood vessels is still a key source of discomfort, but it is not the the primary cause.
So we've discovered so far that migraines are more common in women. Most disorders seem to be, or maybe it's a case of better health seeking behavior in women, but that's another discussion for another day. And what are some of the classic symptoms? Because I know migraines are divided into different types, because one of the things that we come across as physicians is that people list on their past medical history, migraines, and you ask them if they were diagnosed by a doctor, and they say no. I find that it has become a self-diagnosis. Many people diagnose themselves with migraines. So what are the symptoms
So the key symptoms are pain, and the pain is usually at least a moderate severity. It can be on one side of the head or on both sides of the head. In fact, one of the misconceptions is that it's always unilateral, or in other words, always on one side. But it is not always on one side. It can be on both sides. The second thing is that when you have a migraine, you want to stay still, and you become hypersensitive to certain stimuli. Light being very common, noise, and certain smells. Now, so persons become sensitive to light, they prefer to be in a dark room, and this is known as photophobia. It's one of the most, one of the key symptoms. So inability to want to move around. So in other words, migraine can put you to bed. And it is one of the most disabling symptoms that one of the most disabling conditions.
I think persons who have never suffered with a migraine cannot understand how those persons who, you know, gradually the pain comes on and then it reaches a level that you're unable to function. Like you say, it puts you to bed. You have to go lay down, turn off the lights. You beg people to tiptoe.
Yeah, exactly. The other common symptom is nausea. In other words, you're off your food and sometimes vomiting. So those are the key things. And one of the another key point about the pain is that it is has a throbbing quality. It may just say beating, and it beats because of that episodic dilatation of the blood vessels. As the heart beats, the vessels dilate, and that causes pain. So there's a beating quality to the pain. It's severe pain. It's actually one of the most severe pains that a human can be subjected to. And it's far more severe than a pain due, for example, to a brain tumor, which tends to cause a fairly mild headache. Now, having said that, then there are a group of persons with migraine who experience what's known as an aura. About a third of patients get something called an aura, which A-U-R-A, which is a set of symptoms that occur because of changes in the circulation to the brain. And the most common aura is one that is visual phenomena. Yeah, in other words, there is person experiences flashing lights, sometimes with a sharp zigzaggy appearance, which appears in the lateral side of the visual field, and sometimes it takes out the visual field. So you get a blindness, you get an area of blindness, and that's known as a scotoma. This can be very frightening because it can come on, it comes on very gradually, comes across the visual field, and it's sometimes also associated with distortion. Distortion of vision is something called tachypsia. And the only condition that gives you that sort of symptom is migraine. Sometimes the aura can be sensory. Persons experience numbness on one side, and they travel down from the face down to the foot. Sometimes the aura can be a loss of ability to think, to speak even. You can lose ability to remember certain words. Sometimes there is also a weakness. Apart from the numbness down one side, some persons become weak. So it can begin to look like or feel like you're having a stroke.
Stroke, yeah.
And the aura is followed. The headache follows the aura, or the aura is followed by the pain, and then the pain takes over, and that may last for ours today's. And then there is a gradual cessation. And the person may feel a sense of fatigue afterwards, that we call that the post-drogue. So it takes a while before you actually get back to normal. In the whole constellation of symptoms that is a migraine. So a migraine is not just simply a headache.
A headache, yeah.
More to it. And that's why, you know, it takes a while to take a history, to get all of these various components clearly delineated and characterized, you know, but it is very helpful towards making the diagnosis. And of course, it tends to recur. So persons who get one migraine attack, they get go on to get another one. And it's that recurrent tendency to recur, which is one of the things that characterizes migraine. And some of the recurrences may be associated with an aura and some not. And then, interestingly, sometimes you can get the aura and no headache, which again is an interesting thing that happens as we get a bit older. So there's it's a whole set of what some people call a package, a package of symptoms that occurs in the migraine syndrome.
One of the things that I had made mention of in a previous show was about the length of the pediatric history and the length of the psychiatric history as being two of the longest histories that you have to take. Now, when you take into consideration a migraine history, that does, a headache history, it does take some time. And generally speaking, history taken should be or could be the longest part of your examination of a patient, where you're getting information about what the patient is coming with. And you get pretty much the answer or a few answers by the time you finish speaking with the patient. But you see, Prof, when it comes to examination, the examination of the neurological system far exceeds any other exam in terms of length, I think followed closely by cardiovascular. 12 yep. Cranial nerves, a motor system, a sensory system, plus a mental status examination as well, depending on your findings, to do a whole neurological examination. It really is an involved part of medicine.
So, but the examination is very, very important. You have to be, as I said at the beginning, you need to be able to exclude the symptomatic headaches from these primary syndromes. And typically, the person with migraine, once the attack is over, the examination is completely normal, much to their amazement, because when they're going through the headache, when they're going through the migraine episode, it's very uncomfortable. And of course, they may be off work for a couple of days, but once they're back to normal, then the examination should be normal. And if one does a careful exam, then, you know, the scan, the CT scan and so on, becomes less important, actually.
One of the things that in family medicine especially is the patient's fears, what they're afraid of, their wants and desires and wishes and their preconceived notions. Most persons who come with a headache think that they need a CT scan.
Yes.
Is this the case?
That is often the case. But again, it may be if after you've done the evaluation that it seems possible that it is a symptomatic headache, then a CT scan or even an MRI scan may be indicated. But most of the time, if the history is typical, recurrent migraine type headaches, recurrent migraine type symptoms, then you know the CT scan becomes less important, and therefore it comes down again to the severity of the headache. If because the headache is so severe, persons feel that there must be something wrong in my head. I must have burst a blood vessel. I must have something going on in my head. But actually, you know, there are no pain receptors in the brain. The pain receptors on the outside, in the lining of the brain, the dura. So it's one of the misconceptions that people have. And yes, I think often the CT scan is done because the patient asks for it rather than the doctor determining, well, this is what's indicated. But I think we prefer to go the root of, well, I'm doing this scan because I'm looking for A, B, or C, rather than just doing a scan.
It being a request. Understood. Pop, yeah. We have our first call, so we'll take that call before we continue.
Yeah.
Yes, good afternoon. I have headaches most of my life. As a child growing up, I get a lot of headaches. And as an adult now, they got worse. I used to say they're migraine headaches, but for what you're saying, I don't experience any of those symptoms, I don't think. I find if I eat like dairy products or peanut butter or dairy products, peanut butter or cheese, right, that kind. I don't use coffee. People say coffee give migraine headaches too. So what my headache, what caused my headache then?
I am glad the caller raised the question of dietary triggers, because as you know, Renee, we spend a lot of time talking to migraine sufferers about avoiding certain foods which are commonly the triggers. So alcohol, cheese, all forms of cheese, including Parmesan, including soft cheese, hard cheese, and macaroni pie. No, a lot of Belgians believe there's no cheese in macaroni pie.
But oh, can they?
Well, I've come across this. So macaroni pie and hot dogs.
Hot dogs?
Yes, hot dogs contain a substance called nitrites, which can trigger headaches. MSG is one of the most important triggers, and we need to look at the packaging when we buy the spices and sauces and so on. You need to make sure that there's no MSG in there, which can trigger off quite a bad migraine. Certain nuts can do it, and of course, other cured meats. I should mention pepperoni, certain salamis. All of these things contain substances which can cause headaches. So I suspect that the caller hasn't yet discovered. He did mention, I think, peanut butter. So he needs to cut out peanut butter, for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I've cut out peanut butter already. What about sugars? I find if I use sugar, I get problems. So I try to cut out sugar to myself.
Yeah. So, I've heard this. Persons who use a lot of concentrated sugars can get it. As a result, I think also one should mention the need to remain well hydrated.
Hydration.
Because, especially days as they are now, it's easy to become dehydrated and fluid. And that can trigger headaches too. And of course, you know, there's also stress. And I think, Renee, you mentioned about the female hormones. Sometimes there are some persons who do have migraine headaches often around the time of their cycles. And so that is a possibility too.
But okay.
The dietary triggers are important. And, you know, when, as soon as we hear a headache story or headache history that goes back to childhood, the most common or most likely diagnosis is migraine. It's just that, okay, you know, you need to alter certain of your dietary intakes and work with it. You know, you have to ask yourself, well, what did I eat in the last 12 to 24 hours that might have triggered this headache? And, right, you know, you need to be like a detective, try and figure out what it is and cut it out, and really cut it out. Be obsessive about it.
Okay. Thank you so very much. Thank you.
Okay.
You're welcome. And I think one of the things too, Prof, if from childhood you were having these headaches and you're now an adult, chances are it wasn't anything like a malignancy.
Yes. The chances so are you don't need a scan.
Let's talk about one more myth that's so very common. And the classic thing you hear is, I know that my pressure is high because my head is hurting me. Classic. You hear it all the time. People come into the office, I need to get my pressure checked because my head is hurting me.
Mm. Well, it may be the other way around. That because they have a migraine or tension headache, that the pressure goes up. So, but most commonly, hypertension does not cause headache. It's a silent killer, as has been said before, and we need to have our blood pressures checked whether or not we have a headache.
Yes, so we really do advise you, as we do all the time on the show, to keep up with your visits as your doctor recommends, whether it be every 3 or 6 months or your yearly checkup. Make sure that you take advantage of perhaps the persons who might pop in and do blood pressures at your workplaces and so on and so forth, even though there are particular ways blood pressure should be done and under certain conditions. But still, you know, you would pick up somebody that's at risk and they can go on for further treatment. So please pay close attention to your health. Don't wait for that headache. And I know for a fact that at a blood pressure of 220 and 110, there was no noise. So no sound, no headache, no nothing. And that's where the blood pressure reading was. So we can't use that as a symptom. Again, Prof, before we go on, we have another call. Let's take that call.
Mm.
Good evening. Hello. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Hello, good evening, doctor. I would like to know what caused the brain tumor. I will put it down. What caused the brain tumor?
Sure, okay, go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Prof, I'll let you take that one.
Okay. What causes brain tumor? I think a simple way of looking at it is that some brain tumors arise from the nervous system, you know, the nerve cells. And there are different types of nerve cells and also the supportive structure in the brain. And then there is the lining of the brain, as we had mentioned before, called the meninges, and some brain tumors can arise from there too. Now, exactly what causes brain tumors, we actually are not sure. It's as in most cancers, we're just not sure. But it is an important diagnosis to make. When there are symptoms, they are usually not just headache. You get other symptoms. And the process of diagnosis then is followed through, involving sometimes scanning, sometimes biopsy, and so on.
So we really don't know the underlying cause, and perhaps if we knew as doctors what the causes were, we would work so hard to try to prevent anybody getting cancer.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, what I've described is what we call the primary tumors, you know, the tumors that arise from within the head. But as the caller probably recognizes too, that sometimes tumors may spread to the brain from other parts of the body. And one that springs to mind is a lung cancer, which of course we know that the one of the most important predisposing factors is smoking. So, you know, we always warn people about the risk of smoking. And there are other tumors in the body too that may spread to the brain, and we call those
breast cancer, for example.
Yeah, breast cancer and secondary tumors. So again, it's a question of maintaining contact with your practitioners and making sure you get annual checks for these things, because that reduces the risk of tumors appearing.
Prof, we have a third call. So before you press on again, and perhaps we'll jump into the red flags and so on, or those things that would cause us as practitioners to think that it's not just a primary headache, we'll take this call.
Hello, good evening.
Hi, good evening, sir. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a call with one question, but since I heard the doctor mention cigarettes, I want to mention that also. Now, my question is, why barbarians are indulging in the consumption of a lot of fatty foods that causes cancer, all kind of diseases, why they're not practicing healthy eating, the consumption of the lot of pigtails and all kind of nuts, chicken wings, and the cigarettes. I remember when Pastor Roach was alive, he had a program called Here to Cure, and I was a member of that group. And I mentioned that the best way to stop this lung cancer thing, as far as cigarettes is concerned, is stop making cigarettes. They're very damaging to people, especially to those who don't smoke, who inhale the smoker's smoke. And I think that's something that the Ministry of Health have to get involved in, promoting the dangers of this thing. When it's promoting, making people aware. I have a friend whose father was a member of one of the law enforcement organizations, never smoked a cigarette, but by sitting in an office with a man who smoked every day, he died of lung cancer. That man is still alive. Right? And these are things that concern me. Do the right things and live a little longer. Thank you.
Thank you for your comment, sir. One of the things that I would mention here is that there is a wealth of information on the dangers of smoking. On the cartons of cigarettes themselves, the dangers are listed. When you go into the clinics and doctor's offices, there are charts, there are GIS programs. So the issue, sir, is not promoting the dangers associated with smoking. What we need to understand is that persons have choices. And like you spoke about the behaviors with eating pigtails and chicken wings and fast food and not exercising, I believe that persons must be tired hearing the GIS talking about the need to reduce salt and to exercise even more. Doctors can probably just put up a sign and say, okay, I told you this the last time you were here. Exercise is important and so on and so forth. It is a matter of choice at the individual level. Most persons who smoke, when you speak to them about smoking, sir, say, I know that it causes trouble. And sometimes the persons who have never smoked are the ones who end up dying as a result of somebody else. And it's the same thing with alcohol. Some person who has never been drunk gets killed by somebody on the road who is a drunk driver. It's personal choice. And we have to rely on the individual to try their best to make sensible choices. And the other thing to understand is that smoking is an addiction. Smoking is an addiction. So it's not something that necessarily a person can wake up tomorrow and decide. Some people do it. They just stop smoking. Other persons need assistance with smoking cessation. So we are right behind you, sir. We are rallying. We are asking persons to, I said it last week. Last week in my official radio voice, I said, the Minister of Health advises that smoking is bad for your health. Really. So we can only continue to try. But thank you for your comments. They were really valid.
Yep. I endorse what you said about the dangers of cigarette smoking.
Yes. Let's talk then about, because right now, according to my clock, it is now 25 minutes to the hour of 7 in Barbados and the Eastern Caribbean. And for those of you who are now joining us, we are in with consultant neurologist, Professor David Corbin. Professor Corbin is a The word I want is repository, a deep source, a deep reservoir of knowledge when it comes to neurology. I remember there used to be a running joke at the hospital. Well, of course, he wasn't aware of it, but you could actually see the wheels turning in his head as he went through a patient's diagnosis. So we would report to him on ward rounds, and he was in his mind. So you could see him thinking and processing. So he has a wealth of information to share with us. And if you weren't here earlier, we were dealing with the primary headaches. And now we're going to move on, I guess, to those headaches which are a little more sinister.
Yeah. Okay. So when should the person or the person's relative or the patient's parent, guardian, become concerned? I think one of the first things to say is that sinister headaches are often associated with gradual loss of consciousness or gradual drowsiness, loss of inability to speak, to move a limb, or to move limbs on one side of the body, or to have some twisting of the face. The person may also experience some loss of visual acuity, which may occur gradually. And it's important then to make sure that a medical consultation takes place and that a proper examination is done. Because these are signs of what we call raised intracranial pressure. When, in other words, there is, if you think of the head as a rigid area, a rigid box, there is no room for things to expand without causing symptoms. And this is one of the key things about headaches and anything to do with the brain and the symptoms that are caused by things happening within the brain. There is reduction of space, and therefore the remaining brain is under pressure, doesn't work so well, and not only do you get some pain sometimes, but you get loss of function. So the important thing is to report any loss of function. This may even be an alteration of personality. The person becomes rather different. They begin to may lose memory. They may not be the same person that they were. They may become too frivolous, not be able to deal with their financial affairs, and this sort of general symptom that makes that sort of headache in association with those symptoms very, very sinister. And the other thing that I mentioned at the very beginning is a fever. Fever is a very critical sign or symptom or undersign of something happening within the head in association with headache.
Now, and one of the other red flags I had noted as well is persons who are at risk. For example, persons with HIV who are at risk for certain brain infections, for example, that you really do have a higher index of suspicion. You're really more cautious with them when you're diagnosing headaches as you are with another patient who doesn't have an underlying medical condition.
Yes, that's very true. And I think that not only with persons with HIV, but we tend to be, younger. But as we get older, then there is a increase. We need to be increasingly vigilant for problems that occur in that age group, especially if there is no prior history of migraine. So one of the red flags actually is a new headache.
New headache. Mm-hmm.
New headache, a change in headache, or even first ever headache at the age of, say, 50 or 60. That is a red flag in itself, because that person is not used to migraine. They haven't had migraine from childhood like the first caller. This occurring just out of the blue is a red flag. Another red flag perhaps is also the sudden onset of a really bad headache, occurring very suddenly. Never had a headache like it, and that tends to suggest hemorrhage within the brain.
Or even it's sort of difficult to qualify sometimes if some person is having a bad headache, because sometimes, you know, this is the worst pain I've ever had in my life. So many factors influence the way you experience pain on any given day, but usually when somebody says those words, you know, this is the worst headache in my life, and it felt as though somebody hit me at the back of my head with a bat.
Yes. Yeah. If they're not used to having that type of headache, then that is a red flag, needs to be taken seriously.
And that's very cool. Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, and that's where a CT scan needs to be done for sure.
I recall that there was a young lady just a few months postpartum, and she had come into clinic, and I think whilst she was pregnant, she was having headaches as well. At the time, the headaches would have been attributed to maybe pregnancy. Thought it was related to pregnancy, but the headaches got worse after she delivered. And she said something, she said that she was laughing inappropriately. So we spoke just now about personality changes, and she was complaining that she couldn't write like before. And she had several falls. She was trying to get out of bed and she just fell. So we see there she's having these symptoms, personality changes, inability to walk properly or coordinate properly. And those were red flags. And subsequently, it was discovered that she had a brain tumor.
Yeah.
Which had been going all along. So definitely the history is so important.
Yes.
So when you come into the...
You touched on another red flag there, and that is the history of trauma, especially in an older person. And then there's that risk of what we call a chronic subdural hematoma. In other words, a blood clot forming on the surface of the brain that gets bigger and bigger following trauma. And sometimes the person has forgotten about the trauma. It may have happened 3, 4, 5 weeks ago. And they then present with a headache and the other symptoms that I mentioned. So the trauma is a red flag as well.
When we think about the elderly, sometimes they are not, the extremes of age are so very difficult to manage sometimes. Sometimes in an elderly person, you might just see a personality change, and quite often it is the done thing where we attribute it to the person just getting old, or they're getting old and miserable and confused. But we've heard from you that personality changes in the elderly should be taken seriously, and new onset headaches. So
look out
for those things in elderly persons.
Yes, for sure.
What about lumbar punctures? When are they useful in headaches? Yes.
Okay. Well, lumbar puncture is a critical examination in where meningitis is suspected, and meningitis actually may present with headache, but it also presents with fever, loss of awareness, sometimes with seizures, sometimes with loss of function. And provided there is the brain scan is normal, then it is important to proceed to a lumbar puncture. The lumbar puncture is a way of securing cerebrospinal fluid, taking some cerebrospinal fluid from the base of the from the lumbar area, which is at the base of the back, and that fluid is the same fluid that is bathing the brain. So once you examine that fluid under the microscope, you can sometimes make a diagnosis of meningitis based on the increased number of inflammatory cells within the fluid. And it also can be an investigation where you can measure the pressure, and that pressure in the lumbar area, if you do the lumbar puncture well, will reflect the pressure around the brain. And that again gives you an indication of the cause of the headache sometimes and the diagnosis.
We want to move on to treatment, but before we do that, let's take a call. Good evening. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Hi, good evening. Hello.
Hi. Hi, good evening.
Yes, and good evening to the listeners. I have three questions. Are you ready?
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. First, is sugar as bad as salt? That is my first question. My second question is, how do you flush salt out of your body? And my third question, if you stop eating salt, if you stop using salt, what will happen to your body? You have my questions?
Yes, ma'am. I've learned my lesson. I've written the questions down.
All right. Alba, don't listen.
Sure. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Not a word, Gregston.
Not at all. I'm just here smiling.
Yes, we will not mention that debacle that occurred last week.
That I told you to write them down. And you said, no, you got them. And then, boom, we forgot about them. Anyhow, go ahead.
Yes, so let's repeat those questions again. She wanted to know if sugar is as bad as salt. How do you flush salt out of your body? And what would happen to you if you stop using salt? Which one of those do you want to take, Prof?
Okay, well, I'll start by talking about salt. Salt is a name for sodium chloride. Sodium is one of these critical ions in the body. It is a very important source of normal physiology. Without a normal level of sodium, we will not be able to stand up. You have a very low blood pressure. And sometimes we end up with serious illnesses like epilepsy, serious seizures, and basically loss of function. So we need some salt. We need a proper homeostasis, we call it. The sodium in the body needs to be properly regulated. And in most, pretty much in all cases, all healthy people, this happens without us thinking about it. So the caller mentioned flushing out of sodium. Well, that is not really a physiological event. The body is not going to flush out sodium in a normal sense, because that would lead to loss of health and a loss of good health. So I don't know where the caller was going with this question. We sometimes need to reduce the level of salt in if there's excess amount, and which occurs in heart failure, and one would need to use what we call diuretics. But this has nothing to do with, I don't think it's a headache issue. This is more of a homeostasis issue. And, I don't think it is a fair question, because it is either one has good health with normal homeostasis of sodium, or one doesn't.
So the other question she had asked is, if sugar is as bad as salt, and I don't think either sugar or salt is bad. I think the quantities in which they are consumed, therein lies the problem. And perhaps maybe the caller was wondering if you were told by your doctor, I'm just assuming here, if you were told by your doctor to reduce the amount of salt you're using, maybe she was wondering if there was a way to get the salt to go out of your body. But like Prof was just saying, the body regulates salt on its own without our assistance. So we just need to, I guess, pay attention to how much we take in, and the rest will take care of itself.
Yes.
We have another call. Let's take that call before we move on to treatment.
Good evening.
Hi, good evening. Welcome to the Better Health Radio Show.
Yeah, good evening to you, Dr. Rainier, Rick Gregston, and Professor Corbin.
Good evening.
Hi, good evening.
Yeah. Professor Corbin, can you confirm that epilepsy is a neurological condition or disease, whatever it is called?
Yes, I can confirm that.
Right.
I confirm that very strongly because not too long ago, maybe a couple of centuries ago, epilepsy used to be considered a condition due to being possessed by demons. But it is a condition, it's a neurological condition due to.
Okay, so having confirmed that, the question then would be, is there any cure for it, any treatment that can bring it under control, or something that would go away from you?
Yeah, so most of the time we can control the seizures, most of the time, and in fact we can often produce a remission. In other words, once the medications continue, then there are no seizures. But not in all cases. So it has to be, we have to be fair about this. And in about maybe a third of cases, we have some difficulty, and sometimes great difficulty, in controlling the seizures.
So having said that then, Doc, once you are a person suffering with seizures, I would prefer to call it epilepsy.
Yeah.
I don't know if that is scientific name.
Epilepsy means a tendency to recurrent seizures.
Right.
Are not provoked by something obvious, like
right.
a low blood or low calcium or something of that nature.
So then, once you're suffering with this thing, chances are that it can attack you at any time, and depending on where you are, you may or may not get help. But the common thing among we Barbadian people is that, let's say when you are having an attack, that you put something most of your spoon in the mouth. How much truth there is to that? Or how much sense that makes?
Yeah, right. You're absolutely right that seizures are unpredictable most of the time, and you're also right in bringing attention to the bad habit of putting a spoon in the mouth of the person having the seizure, because what that does, it increases the risk of breaking up the teeth, because the proper first aid treatment is to roll the person onto the side and let seizure finish. A seizure will, in most cases, come to a halt within 2 minutes. So you let the person, make sure there's no head injury, make sure the person is safe. If their vomiting occurs, that they're not going to inhale their vomit, but do not put spoon or fingers in the mouth, because either the teeth will be broken and your fingers will suffer damage.
That can make a bad situation worse.
And yes.
The last question I have for you, Doc, is it true to say that when a person is having an attack, that whatever they hold on to, with great ferocity? I mean, like, for example, I was standing next to a guy one time, and he was having a bout, and he held on to a $20 I had in my hand, and I can get it away from him. So someone said, you got to wait till he come out of that.
Yes,
he ain't gonna let it go.
That is true. That's called the tonic phase.
Yeah.
And
okay.
It's an involuntary action.
Thanks for the information. I will continue to listen.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Well, one of the things we want to say about seizures and seizure control is that there are many people in our society who have been diagnosed with epilepsy, who are leading normal lives, who know their triggers, if there are particular things that might trigger them, and who take their medication and keep up with their appointments. And they lead relatively normal lives with few seizures. And then there's some on the other end of the spectrum who don't take their medication and don't keep up appointments, and they have seizures. But most people live an ordinary life. So It's not that once you have the diagnosis of epilepsy, you know, life is finished for you. Not at all. Prof, we have about 4 minutes.
Yes, to tackle treatment.
To tackle treatment or to begin to tackle treatment.
Yes. Well, I think it's important just to say that we're going to talk about the primary headaches and how we treat migraine in particular. We think of it as either an acute treatment for the episode, or we think in terms of preventative treatment if the headaches become too frequent. And the acute treatment tends to be either paracetamol, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug like naproxen. You would know many of these, the codeine that has been used, sometimes with an antiemetic, because as I said earlier, nausea is one of the major symptoms. And with nausea comes that tendency not to absorb medication very well. So the earlier you take the medication, the more likely it is to be properly absorbed. And so we do stress that point at all times. Then there are newer treatments that have been in the last couple of decades. There's been the introduction of triptans, which are specific for migraine. And there are a number of these. The first one was called sumatriptan. There's also rizatriptan and elitriptan and so on. And these are quite expensive in our market, quite expensive. I mean, each tablet may cost about $20. So they are used early in the attack, and they are effective in some persons. Maybe overall, the persons who benefit from that type of treatment is probably around 20%. So it's not a treatment that is helpful for everybody, and it is also a treatment that is we have to be very careful with if there's a history of coronary artery disease or hypertension. And then there is the preventative treatments, of which there are many, and these have been around for a long time. Most commonly, propranolol, amitriptyline, and valproate, topiramate. The last two being anti-epileptic medications as well, but have been shown to do better than placebo in terms of preventing headaches or migraine. And more recently, a set of preventative treatments have been introduced, which interact with the calcitonin gene-related peptide. Calcitonin gene-related peptide is a substance that's recently been characterized as present in the meninges around the brain, and it is released when there is stimulation of the trigeminal system. And there's a set of medications that have recently come out in the last couple of years that are beginning to show great promise in terms of preventing migraine, and in some cases even in treating the acute attacks. So definitely some hope on the horizon for migraine. Now, that type of treatment is often given by injection, because it is a what we call a monoclonal antibody that interacts with the calcitonin gene peptide ligand and or the receptor. Very specific treatment, and it only really works for migraine. So we are on the cusp of something really new and exciting for migraine sufferers in the future. But these medications are quite expensive, and we are really only now beginning to understand how to use that.
Well, it's always good to have you, Prof, and it's good news to end on that there are treatments available for those persons who suffer with debilitating migraines. We want to thank you for taking the time out to be with us over the past hour, and we wish you continued success as the diagnoses turn over in your head. Have a wonderful evening, Prof. Benson.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I turn things back over to you. Have a wonderful evening in the studio.
Thank you kindly. That's Dr. Renee Boyce, and her guest this evening was Professor David Corbin. And for those callers who tried to get through this evening and didn't make it because of our time constraint, we would try to implore you to call earlier during the course of the program instead of just within the last 5 minutes of the program so that we can accommodate your calls. So we've got another program to go on to, so we have to cut the program, the Better Health Radio program, at this time because it is 7 o'clock and we have to go on to the Just Jazz program. But in future, we'd advise you to call us as early as you possibly can so that good doctors can assist you with your questions and comments. All right, Dr. Boyce, thank you as usual, and we will catch you on next week, Sunday, for another session of the Better Health Radio Show, okay? You take care.